Hi, I'm Alex Beam. I'm a columnist for the Boston Globe. This is the nth in a number of so-called hate mail podcasts that I've recorded with producer Ann Silvio and with many guest readers who give voice to the men and women who can't stand my work. We invited back our friend Josh Glenn for this particular podcast. Josh was one of the earliest multimedia producers at the Boston Globe, and I and he developed the original idea for reading some really fantastic invective that we get virtually by the bucketful every time I write. This particular podcast I'm billing as the Love Mail podcast because I'm going to mention two pieces of love mail that came over the transom in the past couple of weeks from highly unexpected sources. And in a way, it almost involves a pop culture quiz when I mentioned that I was going through my snail mail, and very few journalists, I suspect, either get snail mail or even bother to look at what comes in from the United States Postal Service. And I saw a handwritten letter with a very clearly marked return address of Ira Einhorn, E-I-N-H-O-R-N. And I guess I have a strange kind of mind or something, because I immediately knew exactly who Ira Einhorn was. In fact, I specifically remembered a long profile of Ira Einhorn written by my colleague Bella English about 12 or 13 years ago. And if the penny's not dropping for you, I completely understand. I'm totally sympathetic. But Ira Einhorn was a man who became popularly known as, quote, the unicorn killer. He was convicted in an American court, as I recall it, of killing his girlfriend, kind of during the '60s. It was all kind of involved in with drugs and sort of faded memories. And he did what turned out to be a relatively smart thing. He fled to France. As you may or may not know, capital punishment is just a huge issue in Europe. It's a huge issue elsewhere in the world, but Europe, every country in Europe, radically divides with the United States on the issue of capital punishment. As you know, it's a states' rights issue in the United States. Massachusetts does not have capital punishment. However, Pennsylvania, where Einhorn was originally tried, did have capital punishment at the time. In any case, he hid out in France for a very, very long time, and France refused to extradite him. Because it was the popular and political sentiment in France that that even men or women convicted of crimes should not be extradited to countries which had cruel and unusual punishment, which the French consider capital punishment to be. In any case, Einhorn reads the International Herald Tribune, which occasionally runs my column, and I guess he's a crossword puzzle enthusiast because he wrote me a very nice, very well-informed letter praising the column and making some comments about crossword puzzles generally, which I rather suspect Ira has plenty of time to do in the penitentiary in Pennsylvania, where he now resides. I even got a second piece of love mail from yet another kind of man prominent in the popular culture, certainly in the popular culture in Boston. That would be the former chancellor of Boston University, John Silber. I wrote a column that pretty much made fun of a book that John Silber has just written. Silber, as you may or may not know, is a serious intellectual. He has a PhD in philosophy from Yale. He's part of he's what I would call the Austin, Texas Mafia. His early years were teaching at UT Austin with many distinguished intellects, and he's an authority on Kant. It turns out his father was an architect, and John Silber has always held himself out to be something of a kind of an amateur expert on architecture. And he's just published a whole book about his views on architecture, which are basically quite conservative. They're very much in line with Prince Charles's views on architecture. And they're easy to make fun of. They're actually not particularly wrong, and the column was sort of even-handed. Silber hates the Frank Gehry designed Stata Center over at MIT, which I actually think is a kind of a bad building, and I've said so before. But in any case, I wasn't terribly respectful to Silber, who inevitably, during our phone interview, went off on some subject. In this case, you know, he went off on how BU doesn't get any respect. I mean, it's so easy to make John Silber go off. You almost feel guilty when it happens. But I like him. I respect him. I think he's incredibly intelligent. But I know Silber's so subtle that he knows that the last thing I want from him is a letter praising my work, because he knows that in my upside-down universe, I consider that kind of an insult, because my motto is praise saps the strength. In any case, he sent me this relatively brief letter. Dear Alex, thanks for your column, the first public announcement of my book. How did you manage to time it one day before MIT announced its lawsuit against Gary? You have started a ripple effect of interviews and articles. Many thanks, John. He's referring actually to the excellent timing of his book, because literally the day after it was published, MIT sued Frank Gehry because of leaks and construction problems on this very garish building called the Stata Center. In any case, so much for the love mail. Let's get to the hate. So our first piece of hate mail is actually a piece of hate mail we got about the podcast itself, and it came all the way from Belgium.
Dear Alex, I just listened to your August hate mail. It is easy for you to make a mockery of the very moderate reactions that you got. You seem to confuse Esperanto with some other language whose name you forgot long ago. Nevertheless, thank you for remembering the name Esperanto. It shows that you still have some brain cells working. Next time, try and use a word that better fits the sentence. Don't be too ashamed of yourself. After all, there are many people who are too lazy to type Esperanto in Google before writing stupidities about it. P.S. Please use the tone of an adult speaking gently to a 5-year-old child to read my reaction. Thank you. Raymond Gerard.
It's always great to hear from the Esperanto types, one of whom promised me that I could travel from Boston to San Francisco in the United States using only the language Esperanto, and I'm certainly looking forward to that as a project for the coming summer. Well, in September, I did what I would call a pretty obvious column. I don't want to introduce too big a parenthesis, but one of my many mottos is, you know, when someone hands you a column, you have to do it. And as many of you may know, one of the biggest stories on or around mid-September when I did this piece was the death of Alex the parrot, the African gray parrot, who was local, which made it a great story for me. In fact, I mean, Alex, the dead African gray parrot, when living, lived at Brandeis University, about a mile from my home in Newton, Massachusetts. And, you know, Alex's death was just incredible. It was the most emailed story on the New York Times website for several days running. And I had sort of written a somewhat similar column maybe a year before. I can't remember when Barbaro passed away, because I just find it a little bathetic, if you will, you know, when these sort of animal celebrities pass away, and they get far more attention than even the most run-of-the-mill human. And people anthropomorphize, of course, wildly about these animals' accomplishments. Alex the parrot was a subject of considerable scientific dispute. I mean, he supposedly knew 200 words, maybe not. He had this fantastic sort of keeper slash handler slash researcher named Dr. Irene Pepperberg, whom I interviewed for the piece, who on the one hand is incredibly delightful, on the other hand, I think is slightly sort of wacky, if you will. And I did in the column expose some of the wackiness of the Alex cult. I mean, they're selling all manner of keychains and beach blankets and, you know, tank tops with Alex's face on it. I mean, sadly, as it turns out, because no one would give Dr. Pepperberg money to pursue her research, so she had to sort of hawk these tchotchkes in the marketplace. In any case, here's a letter I got from a reader who really didn't like the tone of how I wrote about my namesake, Alex.
Alex, I think I get it. You're pissed because you probably perceive that no one would mourn the loss of you, Alex, the way others mourn the loss of a parrot with the same name. How pathetic. You must think you are very clever, mocking those who care about animals. When the human population these days consists of lowlifes like O.J. Simpson and Britney Spears, how can you spend any time deriding those who care about animals? The case for human versus animal intelligence is being tipped dramatically in favor of the latter. Call it reverse evolution, Jane.
Yeah, call it reverse psychology. Call it whatever you will. I'm still more of a fan of Alex, the columnist, than Alex the parrot. But thank you very much for the letter. So here's some more feedback we got on that column I wrote about crosswords back in September. Incredibly, I managed to alienate a tiny yet extremely literate constituency over my suggestion. I was actually praising a wonderful crossword puzzle that I had read and solved in the Wall Street Journal. And in my column, I praised it and said, the Wall Street Journal created this memorably fun puzzle. So out of nowhere come all the so-called puzzle constructors of North America who hate me for suggesting that the Wall Street Journal actually creates puzzles, or for that matter that the New York Times creates them, or for that matter that Will Shortz created them. In any case, I got involved in an endless chain of email eructations with these constructors who, of course, are incredibly bitter that they actually make these crossword puzzles, but in general, their name appears in like six pica high type. And in fact, it's the men or women who edit the puzzles, Will Shortz being the most famous one. Mike Schenck, I think, is the name of the guy at the Journal. The editors appear to get the credit for creating the puzzles, and the constructors are left kind of at the bottom of the slag heap. One last brief comment I have to say is that I've actually been completely converted to their point of view, even though I call them names in emails that I would prefer not surface from the blogosphere. I kind of get it now. And in fact, the puzzle that I praised in this column was written, created by a woman named Elizabeth Gorski, whose work I've come in contact with since I had this big fight with the other constructors, not with her. And her work is fantastic, and I just want to say how much I enjoy it. Now here's a letter from Russell Brown, who's sort of attacking me as to who actually created this one crossword that I singled out for praise.
The article about crosswords, apparently conceived of, written, edited, and printed by the Boston Globe, for some bizarre reason has your name attached to it. You should bring to the attention of the newspaper that it has accidentally given you credit for something it created.
Dear Alex, in your column you specifically state that the Wall Street Journal created the puzzle. While they may own it because they publish it, just as the New York Times has all rights to the puzzles that they publish, the Wall Street Journal did not create the puzzle. Elizabeth Gorski created it, and the editor, Mike Schenck, presumably assisted in that creation. Would you say that any publishing house has created any of the novels or any works that they publish? No, the author has created the work. A puzzle is no different. Would you say that any museum has created any of the works of art that they own and display? No, the artist is the creator. A puzzle is no different. Nancy Schack.
Well, right, Nancy. Thank you for that letter. I mean, my bias here, frankly, has to do with the newspaper. I don't, I don't own the rights to my columns. On the other hand, I know that many people say, well, how would you feel if it was just unbylined? And people said, oh, well, it was written in the Boston Globe. Well, in fact, you know, a lot of people do cite my work, and they'll say the Boston Globe said that, or the Boston Globe reported that. So the fact that Elizabeth Gorski and other constructors, you know, sell work, as I do, to newspapers, I do sort of feel that, you know, the creativity is subsumed by the entity that publishes it, although of course you're right that a publishing house, you know, doesn't subsume the creativity of a novelist. I was probably coming at this from my knowledge of newspaper copyrights and copyrights generally. I mean, you may well know that all the great comic books of the 50s and 60s didn't belong to their creators. In fact, many of their creators, you know, the creators of Batman and Superman died penniless because DC Comics and the company that owned them owned the rights. So it's a parlous world, and I understand that you, Nancy, and other letter writers just kind of wish that I had given the proper shout-out to the constructors like Elizabeth Gorski. And now, frankly, with the benefit of hindsight, I wish I had. Well, in October, I wrote a column with the headline, My Forbidden Thoughts, for which probably a better headline would have been My Thoughts, Which Never Should Have Appeared in the Newspaper. I had been collecting, actually with friends of mine through email, some sort of completely politically incorrect ideas that you really ever wouldn't want to see published in a family newspaper. I mean, the perfect example was the very first one I wrote about. My wife and I went to an art exhibit during the summer, and it said the proceeds from this art exhibit will be donated to combat the global sex trade. And I stood there for a moment and thought, well, haven't I actually been a beneficiary of the global sex trade? I mean, and I wouldn't want to actually tease that thought out much further, but what about like mail order brides from like the former Eastern Europe? That's like a huge industry now. That's the global sex trade, but they advertise that in the back of the Atlantic Monthly. In any case, I had other thoughts that, again, I was strongly reminded in the future would indeed remain forbidden. I once spotted an interview with Atul Gawande, the Brigham and Women's surgeon, who's sort of the toast of the beau monde in New York because he writes for The New Yorker. And basically, he was performing surgery on somebody with a New York Times reporter next to him and told the New York Times reporter, well, the most important thing in my life now is writing for The New Yorker. And I'm thinking, what about the poor guy on the gurney here whose like appendix has just burst, Dr. Gawande? Shouldn't you maybe be thinking about him? Then yet there was another forbidden thought that I probably should have kept to myself. I once saw this newscaster, and everyone in Boston knows exactly whom I'm speaking about, which is why I absolutely will not mention his or her name. At noon, this person comes on your TV, and this person is just incredibly unattractive, and you don't want to have them on your TV. And it occurred to me, perhaps it's forbidden to think this, but shouldn't really only good-looking people be on TV, reading the news or whatever? So I not only voiced that thought, but then I said, I mean, look who does this right, the Red Sox, because the men who do the Red Sox broadcast are just these fat schlubs. But the women, I compare to a bathing suit contest. I mean, you can't convince me that these people are chosen for their, like, GPA at Tufts. Well, in any case, none of these thoughts probably should have appeared in the paper. There's also one about regretting that Jenna Bush had, like, written an Angelina Jolie-style book about, you know, saving young orphans with AIDS. I mean, I wanted to hear about Jenna Bush at Mr. Smith's on K Street. Excuse me, Mr. Smith's is on M Street. I mean, I wanted to hear about her partying down by Georgetown University. She's a really interesting person. I mean, everyone's saving the AIDS orphans, but not that many people are, like, living the high life in the White House. Maybe enough of those forbidden thoughts for now. Some of the letters.
Mr. Beam, I found your comment about the global sex trade offensive. The global sex trade of which you speak involves enslavement of both women and children. Slavery in the U.S. had beneficiaries. Would you support that trade? Your callous and uninformed comment is among many reasons why, after 25 years of reading and subscribing to The Globe since I was 15, I find myself actively considering canceling my subscription and relying on the much more thoughtful writing I find on favored internet sites. See Alex Hahn, Esquire.
Mr. Hahn, we're begging you, don't cancel that subscription. Oh, come on, it's just lunacy out there on the internet. I have no idea what you're talking about. You have to keep your subscription. You have to read my much more responsible colleagues like James Carroll, Joan Vinaki, Derek Jackson. I'm sure we can find a columnist who will write according to your tastes. Here's yet another reader who didn't like my suggestion about Jenna Bush and writing her kind of heartwarming tale about her orphan friend. As I said, I was just sort of incredibly shocked that Jenna Bush wouldn't tell us about her Amy Carter-like experiences in the White House. I even had an alternate suggestion for the title of her book, which was Slipping My Boyfriends Past the Secret Service. But I realize now I never should have wrote that. That won't get past my editor a second time. I take it all back. I tried to publish this column on Columbus Day. I didn't think anyone was reading. These thoughts are forbidden. There's a reason they're forbidden. And from now on, they're going to be completely forbidden. Here's another letter.
Dear Alex, when I read your column today, it made me angry and sad. You know it was a cheap shot toward Jenna Bush. Maybe there is another book that will come out about party girls in Austin or sneaking boyfriends past the Secret Service. As a mother of a 21-year-old daughter in college and a 24-year-old son, who is trying to help them make sense of our world today and trying some way to make it better, I was happy to talk to them about Jenna's book. Come on, with all these young celebrities today who have awful problems, isn't her message at least somewhat good? Do you have children? What topics would you like to discuss with your kids tonight over the dinner table? Jenna's book or Paris's cheeseburger ad?
Well, Susan, thank you for your letter. Actually, I have children exactly the same age as yours. I have a 21-year-old son in college, and I have a 24-year-old son in the workforce. I guess at the end of the day, I'm just totally cynical about these foxhole conversions. I mean, you mentioned, you know, Paris Hilton, who with a tremendous amount of media attention went to jail and came back, telling Larry King that she believed in Jesus Christ, whoever that was. And I find it objectionable. I find it insulting. And I find the notion that Jenna Bush, whom I have no brief for or against, I'm not particularly anti-Bush. I'm not particularly anti-Bush family. But I find it a joke, and as I would say, insulting and sort of contrary to normal logic, that you would lead a life in one direction, and then for, it seems to me, reasons really only of publicity, you would come forward and claim to suddenly have some sort of deep felt commitment to orphans in faraway lands or whatever. I guess I'd like to teach my own children to keep their own lives and what surrounds their lives real, and I think everyone should be held to that same standard. So after the Boston Red Sox won the World Series, I printed a column that I had actually written a number of weeks before, and it occurred to me really after the Red Sox beat the Cleveland Indians that you could write a sort of a tongue-in-cheek faux sentimental piece about feeling sorry for the New York Yankees. And I had a friend who actually followed the Yankees who gave me a lot of the information. I don't really care that much about the Yankees, although, I mean, any woe that betides them is cause for joy in my heart. But anyway, my friend fed me some really horrible details of George Steinbrenner's physical decrepitude and the really not very nice story of his son-in-law Steve Swindle, who was supposed to take over the Yankees, and then his marriage of 25 years to Steinbrenner's daughter broke up, and then Swindle drove his car into some kind of like post down in South Florida and got picked up by the cops for drunk driving. So anyway, I wrote this whole kind of like crocodile tears piece about how we, from our gracious perch as 2007 World Baseball champions, should really not be sparing tears and pity the New York Yankees. I would have to say, several hundred emails in response, and this one from Jared Quartel is certainly quite typical.
Hey, A-Beam, let me give you an A-Ream. It is you who are pitiful. 86 years of angst all rolled up into one pathetic tirade. You left out one of the most important adjectives from your exposition. That would be dynasty, the Tory dynasty, the Steinbrenner dynasty, the 26 World Championships dynasty. So the Sox won 2 in 4 years. Ever win 4 in 4 years? I didn't think so. Yes, you won this year, and as far as the New England mentality of what have you done lately is still fresh in your minds, time will pass, and you'll just be another two-hit wonder, while the Yankees are still the most prolific and celebrated franchise in the history of sports. Thanks for Babe Ruth, and thanks for losing all those years. Jared Quartel.
Jared, thanks for thinking of me. Thanks for coming to Boston, and thank you for reading the Boston Globe. Continuing in this vein, here's a letter from Elizabeth Rubinstone.
Although admittedly your writing surpasses that of a junior high student, your facile sardonicism does not. Insightful criticism of a team or its members are a good story. Puerile sarcasm only impugns the writer, perhaps more than his subjects, and wastes the reader's time. Maybe it's time that you put away your copy of A Catcher in the Rye and grow up.
Great letter, Elizabeth. Thank you very much. I will put away my copy of The Catcher in the Rye, but Puerile sarcasm is practically my middle name, so I can't do everything that you ask. Here's yet another letter from a reader named Elaine.
Alex, surely this is a tongue-in-cheek article. What do I say to Yankee fans? My heart is not breaking for you. No pity, no prisoners. Amen.
Amen indeed, Elaine. No hugging, no laughing, and no good wishes for the Yankees. But no good wishes for Alex. Here's 3 more letters relegating me to baseball hell.
Nice job of using only a handful of factors to create your Sox fluff piece. And while you celebrate the aging of the Messinas, Clemens, and company, you fail to mention the youth movement of Hughes, Chamberlain, and Kennedy coming right behind them. And as for A-Rod, are you high? Do you really think he has anything to do with the Yankees' success? If anything, A-Rod coming to the Yankees symbolically ended one team's 86-year-old curse, and Sox fans should be hoping that dark cloud resides in pinstripes for years to come. You'd like the Yankees to be pathetic, but since you're predicting the next baseball season in November, pathetic may just be part of your expertise. Celebrate the fact that your team won, but do it with some class, you hack. Your short-lived moment is just about over, so wring out all the self-gratification you can muster out of it. Roy Giovannone.
Dear Alex, you are a lightweight jerk from Boston. Go back to journalism school and learn to read and write. The only ones to feel sorry for are you, your dopey town, and your team, who we will crush next year. Sincerely, Marian Patterson, fan of the 26-time world champion New York Yankees.
Alex, just read your article on the, according to you, demise of the New York Yankees. What a load of garbage! Please save your pity. You claim the pitching is ready for the glue factory. Apparently you have not read your newspaper up in Cowtown. Perchance did you ever read about Joba & Co.? Do you realize that Joba was the asking price by Texas for the immortal tomato can, one Vern Gagne? I really hope the denizens of that country bumpkin town will enjoy his efforts. Oh yeah, the Sox are really developing into a dynasty. They've won 2 World Series in the last 90 years. Now there's a team to be feared. Anonymous.
Yes, fear indeed. We're quaking in our boots up here in Boston. All I know from this fantastic response to the Yankees column is that I'm going to be writing about the Yankees every month now. I want Dan Shaughnessy's email. I love these columns. I love these letters. I revel in the scorn and the hatred of the Bronx Bombers and their fans. Thank you very much.